Hello, and welcome to this first episode of the new third season of The Dark Money Files, in which we shine a light into a murky world. I'm Ray Blake, and with me is my co-host, friend, and business partner, Graham Barrow. Hello, Graham.
Hello, Ray.
So, it's a new season, Graham, and I recall we promised to look at the European Commission's report on recent money laundering revelations across Europe.
Well, Ray, yes, that's right, and it has the rather snappily titled, quote, Report from the Commission to the European Parliament and the Council on the Assessment of Recent Alleged Money Laundering Cases Involving EU Credit Institutions.
And I think that despite the carefully hedged title, this is a fairly direct report, isn't it?
Well, yes, I think that's fair. It's a pretty stark review of 10 case studies in the past few years and suggests what lessons might be learned from them.
And we know what the 10 case studies are because the report lists them. Let me quote from the footnote that does that.
Oh, please do.
The cases are, and I quote, ABLV Bank in relation to events that led to the closure of the bank, Danske Bank in relation to events that led to the closure of its Estonian branch, Deutsche Bank in relation to the Mirror Trade case that led to the imposition of fines, FBME Bank in relation to events that led to its closure, ING in relation to events that triggered the settlement with the Dutch public prosecutor, Nordea in relation to events that triggered fines for anti-money laundering compliance deficiencies, Pilatus Bank in relation to events that led to its closure, Satta Bank in relation to events that led to restrictions of its operations, Societe Generale in relation to events that led to the imposition of fines for anti-money laundering compliance deficiencies, Verso Bank in relation to events that led to the bank's closure.
That's some list, Ray. And and having considered it, Ray, I have just the one question.
What's that, Graham?
Why does the Commissioner's choice of document title refer to alleged money laundering cases?
Well, that's a question for them, I think, but I certainly take your point, Graham.
Well, yeah, perhaps we should move on and look at what some of the findings are. The Commission identifies lessons for two quite distinct groups, for credit institutions and also for supervisory authorities.
Yes, and it also comments on what it sees as remaining structural issues at the EU level, concluding that it may be time to consider moving AML from directive status to a regulation.
Yes. Now, before we go on, Ray, should I explain the difference for those who may not be up to speed on European matters?
That's a good idea.
Okay, so a directive is an articulation of goals to be achieved by all member states, but it is left to individual member states to determine the nature of their implementation and, well, to some extent at least, the timing. A regulation, on the other hand, supersedes national law and sets binding requirements that apply from a fixed date.
So it's like going up a gear, removing any local discretion.
Yes, it would quite literally be laying down the law.
Well, I think that's a good framing for us to look in detail at the findings that led the Commission to advocate that move.
Yes. So shall we start with what the Commission identified in relation to credit institutions, the lessons for firms?
Yes, let's do that. So first, the analysis identified four broad categories under which shortcomings could be grouped, but typically they're rather dry and wordy definitions, so maybe we should try and interpret them in rather more everyday language.
I think that's a really good idea. So should we take them one at a time then?
Yes. The first one is, and I'm quoting, ineffective or lack of compliance with the legal requirements for anti-money laundering / countering the financing of terrorism systems and controls.
That's easy for you to say.
Well, you'd be surprised.
Put another way, let's say firms don't always have the policies and controls in place required by the rules.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Secondly, there is, and I'm quoting, governance failures in relation to anti-money laundering / countering the financing of terrorism.
Or in simple terms, firms have put the policies and controls in place, but not necessarily the infrastructure that ensures everyone sticks to them. Yeah. Then there's what the Commission calls, quote, misalignments between risk appetite and risk management.
or you want to do really risky business, but you don't have the policies and controls in place to manage it.
Yeah.
And finally, it says, quote, negligence of group anti-money laundering stroke countering the financing of terrorism policies.
Or in our language, you've got the policies and controls in place, but where people decide they don't want to stick to them, you're unable to identify that that's the case.
Exactly. Now, the difference between two and four is quite subtle, but I think it's important. One is more aimed at failures to implement the rules, and the other at spotting when the rules aren't being implemented.
Mm. And I'm sure we can think of several examples for each of those categories.
Well, I'm sure you're right, Ray, but then, to be honest, the Commission has saved us the trouble.
Well, true. What does come through straight away, though, is the belief that one of the fundamental problems with some firms is that they don't prioritise anti-money laundering highly enough.
And that's a point we've made before, Ray. But the issue here could well be that credit risk and fraud cost the banks money in direct financial loss. But by and large, they make money from transactions involving criminal funds. So they might not have the same overt incentives to prioritise it.
But we might argue that over the last few years, the number of terrible headlines faced by most of the banks that feature in this report is itself starting to change that calculation.
Do you know, I wouldn't disagree with that sentiment. Okay, so lack of priority is mentioned. What else?
Well, the things that flow on from that. Inadequate resources and budgets, which then flow through into inadequacies at the operational level in respect of onboarding and ongoing monitoring.
Do you know, it all sounds so easy to fix when you put it like that, right?
Well, I think at a basic level, it probably is, at least in terms of meeting the legal and regulatory requirements. It's a different matter when it comes to excluding the criminal funds from the system, though.
You know, that's so true. And maybe, you know, maybe that would be a good subject for a future episode. Mm. We maybe should talk about what stops existing regulations from effectively identifying and stopping dark money entering the system.
Mm, yeah, I'd agree. Going back to the report, though, for now, the other thing that comes through very strongly is that the point of the whole client due diligence process, both at outset and ongoing, is to understand properly the underlying client and the nature of business that they're doing.
Yeah, sounds easy as well, doesn't it? Shall we then look at some of the case studies they use to exemplify that problem and the four broad areas of concern?
Mm, yeah, okay. So let's start with governance failures.
I can't imagine what example they chanced upon for this one, Ray.
Let me quote you the case study in full. It's not very long, and it says, in one case, it was pursuant to a whistleblower report about risky business and suspicious money flows in certain group entities that the board triggered internal investigations. Local management had not reported any issues to the board, nor did the board read local internal audit reports drafted in local language.
A whistleblower, you say?
Yes, Graham.
And internal audit reports in a local language that clearly differed from the main language used in the bank.
Yes, Graham.
Any ideas?
Well, I think we might have mentioned them once or twice.
Okay. Right, let's move on. What about the comments on senior management then?
Again, it's a relatively brief comment. Here it is. In one instance, the composition of the management board of the bank has changed several times, including upon request of the supervisory authority. The supervisor was dissatisfied with the inability of several consecutive boards to steer the business away from an exclusive focus on high-risk areas or customers.
Now, that's interesting, isn't it? I wonder if part of the problem here, guessing, is that there's an assumption, especially by AML teams inside these institutions, that senior management really do understand the issues.
Whereas we know from real-world experience that senior management teams must grapple with risks from right across the business, from credit to operational to reputational to environmental and all sorts of others. They're extremely reliant on the in-house experts relating to each of these risks to articulate them and assertively put them forward. And actually, it's very easy to slip here, if you're senior management, into a worldview that says you run the strategy of the bank and all of the other risk functions clear up after you.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And frankly, because money laundering risks are more subtle than dealing with a computer failure or a massive loan default, it can be hard to compete with some of the other voices and, I guess, get the requisite budgets and resources to meet those requirements.
Well, yeah, until you get fined £163 million or named by the US as a primary money laundering concern. Yeah, yes, I think it might be.
Yeah, point taken. Okay, the next case study.
Risk appetite, Graham.
Risk appetite or lack of one, as the case may be.
Well, quite. This one reads, in one case, a credit institution had attracted many of its customers through a system of references that paid so-called introducers to bring in new clients while relying on the same introducers to check the prospective client's probity. Customers paid the introducers as well. There is no evidence of clients being rejected during this process, although the credit institution did close some customer accounts and cut ties with a number of introducers when it was fined for weak money laundering controls by the supervisor.
Ow. Okay, so Ray, I didn't detect a single conflict of interest in there.
Well, I don't think you were listening then. But that's why introduced business needs to be treated with great care. And then finally, in relation to credit institutions, at least, the report talks about the issues faced by banks with multi-jurisdictional businesses.
Yeah, and the need to ensure conformance with their home regulator, even when this applies a standard higher than required in the local jurisdiction. And that's always been problematic to firms who, let's say, place the need to generate profit higher than the need to do so compliantly.
And I mean, we've had some quite interesting conversations in that respect before, haven't we?
Oh, yes. So those were the lessons to be learned by firms. Shall we move on then to the findings related to the supervisory authorities for each of the EU countries? What do the national regulators have to learn?
Okay. Well, the first thing the report looked at was variations in the way different countries supervise for anti-money laundering. Once again, adequate resources and budget was an issue, along with where it came in the overall priority attaching to AML at a government level.
Yeah, and once again, and the report makes clear that the credit crunch and all that flowed from it has definitely had an impact.
Yeah, and it's probably deeper than most people realise.
Ooh, how so?
Well, firstly, as the report makes clear, it caused a focus on credit and liquidity in the financial system as opposed to money laundering and other forms of financial crime, causing it to be reprioritised to a lower level. But conversely, it probably also caused a huge upsurge in corruption and money laundering, as those corrupt or criminal actors in positions of authority sought to shelter as much money for their own benefit as they possibly could in case it was lost through the fallout from the credit crunch.
Do you know, that is a really good point, Ray, and I'm not sure it's one I've particularly thought about before. So maybe some of these high-profile cases which have come to light today are a result of this double whammy of decreased focus on supervision at a time of increased money laundering activity.
It's a theory. And it also needs to be viewed against this background of light touch supervision in some cases.
Oh, that's a terrible expression. Yeah. Did they give any specific examples?
Well, yes. One of the case studies is about exactly that. The report says, In one member state, the relevant national anti-money laundering / countering the financing of terrorism supervisor explained that the supervisory culture was of a non-intrusive nature and built on trust. The supervisor relied mainly, but not exclusively, on off-site reviews, written exchanges with the supervised entities, and had never imposed sanctions or taken other supervisory measures.
Well, they're lovely sentiments. maybe not entirely rooted in a deep understanding of how these things actually work.
Well, no.
But a jolly good example. What were some of the other issues that they identified then?
Well, the perennial issue of who's responsible for the supervision, home or host supervisor.
Oh, well, that was definitely a factor at Danske.
Yes, the report makes clear that the division of responsibility, especially when supervising a branch rather than a separate legal entity, was often unclear. At least it was until the publication of the fourth anti-money laundering directive.
Now, for those who haven't encountered this conundrum, is it worth a minute on just explaining branch versus subsidiary?
Yeah, why not? Let's say you have a bank. We'll call it Graham's Bank PLC, and establish it in London. It's regulated by the FCA for conduct issues and by the PRA for prudential matters.
Well, that sounds like a very well-run and profitable bank, Ray.
Indeed, Graham. So much so that it decides to expand internationally. It builds an office in France and starts doing business there with French customers.
Oh, très bien. And this is a branch, is it?
Yes, it is. Just like it might open a branch in Walthamstow, in Doncaster, or in Glasgow, it opens one in Paris. The same directors and owners based in London take the French branch profits or foot the French branch losses.
Gotcha. So what's the alternative, Ray?
Well, we might instead form Bonk Graham SARL.
I like the sound of that.
Now, this firm has a board of directors in Paris. It's got a separate incorporation from the parent bank, and it's got its own balance sheet and accounts. It's fairly clear that its primary supervisors as a French firm are going to be the French Banking Commission and the ACPR.
I see. But what about our branch in Paris then, Ray? If it's a branch of the UK bank and its directors are in the UK and so are its owners and its profits go to a UK balance sheet and are part of the UK firm's accounts, who regulates the branch?
Well, you've put your finger on the issue, Graham. Whether the overseas operations are branches or subsidiaries, the different regulatory relationships can get a bit tangled. For instance, there was exactly this sort of confusion with Danske.
Yes, and thinking about it, presumably if a firm has both branches and separate legal entities in other countries, that makes it even worse.
Well, it does. And I mean, you know, you have the sign of the letterhead from the office in France saying regulated by the FCA.
Yeah. Okay.
In English.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's pretty clear that there definitely was a lack of communication and understanding between the Estonian and Danish regulators in respect of Danske,
yeah,
for all of those reasons, which ended up with the somewhat unedifying spectacle of each publicly blaming the other for some of the failings.
Yes, and then there's a lovely little note in the Commission's report that although the EU money laundering directives required member states to apply, quotes, effective, proportionate and dissuasive, quotes, sanctions, in one member state, the maximum fine was €46,500 per infringement.
Oh, well, you'd need a lot of infringements before that became, quotes, effective, proportionate and dissuasive.
Quite so, a little bit like getting 37 yellow cards before you're sent off.
Yeah.
And the report also makes the point that home host supervision can be made more complicated when the supervisors themselves are structured differently.
Yes, whereas here in the UK we have one supervisor for prudential regulation, which is the Prudential Regulation Authority, and a second supervisor for both conduct and financial crime risk, which is the Financial Conduct Authority, the FCA. It isn't like this everywhere, is it?
No, exactly. Some member states have a unified approach to supervision, often under the auspices of the central bank, who've got all sorts of other things to do, which means that some elements can fall through the cracks.
Yes, absolutely. And then we get to the thorny issue of cooperation within the EU.
And the impending potential withdrawal of the UK from that cooperation.
Yeah, and in the absence of a published deal or, frankly, anything resembling one, it's currently in the lap of the gods as to what will happen next.
Except it's pretty clear to us that if we leave with no deal, we're extremely likely to be cut off from information and intelligence sharing in the financial crime arena. And it's hard to think this will be anything other than a bit of a disaster in the fight against money laundering.
Yeah, odd when you think about who is alleged to have been involved in external interference in the referendum and who is likely to benefit most, at least within our world, from that breakdown in intelligence sharing.
Well, it's one way of looking at it, yeah.
Yeah. And that brings us ultimately to the direction of travel of the EU, with or without, frankly, the UK as members.
Yes. And as I said at the beginning of the podcast, one of the things that the European Commission is putting forward for serious consideration is changing the approach to anti-money laundering from a directive, which leaves individual countries some latitude in how they transpose the directive into law, to instead a regulation with the appropriate EU-level supervisory body, presumably, to oversee it.
Yeah, and putting to one side the political debate over that decision, I think we'd both agree that a unified approach would almost certainly remove some of the ability of the bad guys out there to leverage differences in the way banks are currently supervised to the bad guys' own advantage.
Oh, I completely agree. So that's the European Commission report, Graham. What's up next for us?
Well, Ray, quite excitingly, as you know only too well, because we've been working hard at it, we are making preparations for the very first Dark Money Files live event, along with our partners at LexisNexis Risk Solutions, which will be taking place in London on the 17th of September.
And with more planned.
Well, all being well, yes. So maybe as a prelude to that, we should do an episode looking back at what's happened in the last 9 months that we've been doing this podcast.
9 months, Graham. Wow.
It went really quickly, didn't it?
It did.
And maybe we should just look forward to some of the things that are in store between now and the end of the year.
I'm looking forward to it. The end of the year, that is.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Dark Money Files. We hope you enjoyed it. If you would like to listen to future episodes, please subscribe through iTunes, Spotify, or your normal podcast provider. Thanks.